Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're the show engineer to take that huge stack of SOX material you've got and really distill it down into, well, pure, actionable insight.
And today, we are plunging deep into a topic that's generating just massive buzz, but is still, I think, widely misunderstood.
We're talking about peptides.
Exactly. Mm. And, you know, this isn't just some fleeting trend. We're looking at what could be a real paradigm shift in therapeutics.
You see them everywhere mentioned by celebrities. Jennifer Aniston, Jackman, Stallone. Joe Rogan talks about them.
Right. And high-performance athletes using them for, like, radical recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, folks looking into serious longevity goals.
The claims are pretty huge, aren't they? We're talking compounds that supposedly help heal chronic injuries, build muscle mass safely,
boost metabolism, even potentially dial back some aspects of aging.
Yeah.
Our sources today are really rich. We're drawing from functional medicine practitioners, industry advocates.
People who are explaining both the biochemistry, which is fascinating, and this critical high-stakes regulatory battle that's happening right now, mainly in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. It's made some really popular compounds suddenly very difficult to get your hands on.
So our mission for you, the learner, is pretty clear today. We want you to walk away with a thorough understanding of what peptides actually are.
What are their specific claimed benefits? How are they fundamentally different from, say, traditional hormone replacement therapy, HRT?
And why have these tiny compounds become this sort of unexpected flashpoint in a medical freedom debate?
Yeah, it's time to cut through the hype, look at the science, and understand what's really going on.
Okay, let's start right at the beginning then. Before we jump into how they're used, we need that clear definition. Biologically speaking, what is a peptide?
Fundamentally, it's simple. Peptides are just small chains of amino acids. Usually, we're talking between 2 and 50 amino acids linked together.
Okay, small chains.
But the critical part is their function. They act as signaling molecules in the body. They're short, they're fast, they're directive.
Signaling molecules, like messengers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We often use this analogy. Mm. Think of peptides as the body's little post-it notes, short directive messages.
Okay.
Telling a cell exactly what to do right now. Repair this tissue, release this growth factor, modulate that immune response. Quick commands.
Ah, I like that. Post-it notes. Simple, direct.
Right. And you contrast that with proteins, which are the longer paints, 50 or more amino acids.
Gotcha.
Proteins are more like the body's long, detailed instruction manuals. They handle the big structural stuff, building hair, skin, muscle fibers.
Got it. So peptides regulate, proteins build.
Primarily, yes. Peptides are regulatory. They manage cellular communication, tissue repair, hormone release.
Right.
And their small size is key. It makes them incredibly efficient at getting those biological messages across quickly.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's jump right into the practical side then, especially the peptides getting the most attention for physical repair. And these are also the ones right at the center of that regulatory fight we mentioned.
Yeah, BPC 157 and TB500, they often come up together.
Let's start with BPC 157, body protective compound. What's the story there?
BPC 157 is, well, it's fascinating because of its origin. It's a synthetic peptide, but it's derived from a compound that naturally occurs in our own gastric juices.
Gastric juices, like in the stomach.
Exactly. Stomach and duodenum. And its regenerative profile is incredibly broad. It's not just for one thing.
The sources really emphasize its use for soft tissue repair, muscles, tendons, ligaments. That alone sounds like a huge deal for anyone with nagging injuries.
Oh, absolutely. But it goes way beyond just joint pain, you know?
Yeah.
Because of where it comes from, the gut.
Oh, okay.
It has strong anti-inflammatory properties and seems uniquely suited for intestinal healing. Practitioners use it a lot for chronic gut problems.
Like what kind of gut problems?
Things like leaky gut, IBS irritable bowel syndrome, IBD inflammatory bowel disease, even SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth.
Wow.
The idea is that BPC 157 helps regenerate and heal the mucosal lining of the GI tract, sort of patches things up.
So because it's derived from stomach juice, taking it orally actually works well for gut issues. It survives the stomach acid.
That's the theory, yes. It's stable in that environment. Oral administration is often preferred for gut-specific health.
But what if you've torn something in your shoulder or you have inflammation elsewhere?
Right. For a specific injury like that, or for more systemic inflammation, the injectable form is usually recommended. Typically, it's injected into the subcutaneous fat tissue.
Why inject it there?
It generally offers the highest absorption rate and delivers the most powerful effect, whether you need it localized to that shoulder or working throughout your system.
The stories in the source material about recovery are pretty striking. I remember one about a doctor with a severe spinal infection.
Yes, an abscess, I believe. And the conventional prognosis was grim. maybe permanent disability.
And the sources claim using peptides, likely including BPC-157, dramatically sped up his recovery beyond what doctors expected.
That's the claim. Restored function that was feared lost. And that kind of accelerated healing seems to be a recurring theme.
Like the athletes healing ACL tears.
Exactly. Another source mentioned patients recovering from ACL surgery unbelievably fast, according to their orthopedic surgeons.
Which is incredible because ACL recovery is usually brutal, right? 6-9 months minimum.
Easily. So if someone reports, say, chronic lower back pain resolving in just 2 or 3 weeks using these peptides, that's a massive shift in quality of life. It really captures why people get excited about them.
That difference in speed is key. Now, you mentioned BPC-157 often comes with a partner, TB-500. Why are they usually paired up?
Good question. TB-500, its full name is somosin beta-4, is also naturally produced in the body, primarily in the thymus gland. It's crucial for the whole tissue repair process.
How does it complement BPC-157? What's its specific job?
Okay, technically, its key role is as an actin sequestering protein.
Whoa, okay, actin sequestering. Let's break that down. What's actin and why does sequestering it matter?
Right, actin is basically the internal scaffolding, the cytoskeleton, inside your cells. It gives them structure, but importantly, it also allows them to move.
Ah, cell movement.
Yes. TB-500 helps regulate and direct that actin. It controls cell motility, how cells move and migrate.
So if BPC-157 is like the repair crew bringing new materials?
Yeah, the new girders and concrete, to use that analogy.
Then TB-500 is like the foreman directing traffic, making sure the crew and materials get to the right spot efficiently.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
It ensures that healing factors and the necessary restorative cells can actually travel quickly and efficiently to the site of that torn tendon or damaged tissue.
So TB-500 enhances the communication and delivery part of healing.
Precisely. You could inject BPC-157 alone and you'd get healing factors. But if your cellular communication pathways are sluggish, maybe due to age or chronic inflammation, the repair is slow.
Okay.
Combine them and you get both the raw materials for repair and an efficient delivery system. It optimizes the whole process.
Makes perfect sense. So for someone dealing with a significant injury, what's a typical usage protocol look like according to the sources?
For targeted repair, the sources often mention cycling about 5 milligrams of BPC-157 and 5 milligrams of TB-500 per week.
How is that usually taken? Daily?
Often, yeah. It might be broken down into daily 1 milligram injections of each. And this would run for a specific period, usually somewhere between 6 to 12 weeks, to allow for comprehensive healing and tissue remodeling.
Okay, so that covers the direct healing aspect. Let's shift gears now from fixing injuries to actually optimizing the body. This is where peptides get into performance, muscle mass, metabolism, anti-aging.
And this area heavily involves peptides related to growth hormone. But there's a really critical distinction we need to make right away.
Okay, what's up?
We're talking about growth hormone-releasing peptides, GHRPs. Things like CJC-1295, ipamorelin, sermorelin, tesamorelin. These are fundamentally different from just injecting straight growth hormone or GH.
Right. And for listeners new to this, why is that distinction so crucial, especially for safety and long-term health?
Because these GHRPs are what we call secret agogs. They don't just dump external hormone into your system.
They don't override the body system.
Exactly. Instead, they gently stimulate your own pituitary gland, the body's natural control center, for GH to produce and release growth hormone itself.
So it's more natural.
Yes. And importantly, it tends to follow the body's optimal, natural pulsatile rhythm. It mimics how a younger, healthier body would release GH.
And the danger of bypassing that natural system by using straight GH injections? The sources seemed pretty clear on the downsides.
Oh, yeah. When you flood your body with external GH, your system recognizes that, whoa, tons of GH coming in, and it shuts down its own production. That's the dreaded reverse feedback loop.
And that leads to problems.
Long-term, high-dose use can lead to dependency and some significant side effects. The sources mention things like swelling, which can cause bad joint pain.
And even physical changes?
In some cases, yeah. If bone growth plates aren't fully closed, you could get unwanted bone growth. The classic examples are forehead or jaw enlargement. Plus, issues like carpal tunnel syndrome from soft tissue swelling.
Yikes. Okay, so GHRPs avoid that by working with the body's system.
Right. They encourage the body to make the proper, natural amount, which significantly reduces those risks while still offering benefits.
And what benefits are people typically looking for when they cycle these GHRPs?
The effects tend to be systemic. People report dramatic improvements in sleep quality, which makes sense since a lot of GH is released during deep sleep.
Okay.
Also, noticeable increases in lean muscle mass, improvements in bone density, and even enhanced cognitive function or clarity.
Better thinking. Interesting. Was there specific data on muscle gain?
There was one compelling anecdote in the sources. A practitioner reported a patient gaining 5 pounds of lean muscle while simultaneously lowering body fat just by cycling tesamorelin alongside their regular fitness routine.
5 pounds of muscle while losing fat. That's pretty significant. Now, what about the protocol? You said cycling, so you don't take these continuously.
Absolutely not. That's crucial. To prevent your body's receptors from becoming desensitized or numb to the signal, and to maintain your pituitary's own ability to produce GH, you have to cycle them.
How does that usually work?
A common approach mentioned is something like 3 months on, then 3 months off, or maybe structuring it so you're using them for about 6 months out of the year in total. And typically administration is 5 or 6 days a week, not every single day.
And then there's that famous, almost infamous rule about timing and fasting. This seems non-negotiable.
It truly is. The timing matters because you want to amplify the body's natural GH pulses. So injections are often recommended once in the morning and once at night right before bed to hit that deep sleep release window.
Okay, morning and night.
But the absolute must-follow rule is the fasting window. You need to fast, meaning nothing but water, for 90 minutes before the injection, and then for another 30 minutes after the injection.
Wow, a full 2-hour window around the injection with no food. Why is that so strict? Why would eating carbs or protein during that time basically waste the peptide?
It all comes down to insulin.
Ah, okay.
The moment you eat carbohydrates or protein, your body releases insulin to shuttle those nutrients into your cells.
Mm.
And insulin is the direct antagonist, the opponent of growth hormone.
They counteract each other.
Exactly. When insulin levels spike, it sends a strong signal to your body to stop releasing GH. So if you eat too close to your injection time, you trigger this insulin response, and it effectively shuts down your pituitary's ability to respond to the GHRP signal.
Making the injection kind of useless for boosting GH.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
You lose
yeah.
that intended hormonal spike. So yeah, understanding that insulin-GH relationship is absolutely key to getting results with these peptides, you have to respect the fasting window.
That's a fantastic explanation. Okay, shifting focus slightly within optimization, what about peptides specifically aimed at metabolism and energy production?
Yeah, there are compounds that target metabolism more directly. We mentioned tesamorelin, again, seems particularly good for reducing visceral fat.
That's the dangerous fat around the organs, right?
Exactly. The stuff linked to serious chronic diseases.
Mm-hmm.
But the sources also pointed to a deeper approach, targeting the mitochondria themselves, the actual energy factories in our cells.
This is where those futuristic-sounding names came in, MCC and SS31. MCC was linked to something called AMPK activation.
Yes. MCC works to enhance mitochondrial function, partly by activating a crucial enzyme called AMPK adenosine, monophosphate-activated protein kinase.
AMPK, why is that important?
AMPK is often called the master regulator of metabolism. When it gets activated, it's like a signal to the cell that energy stores are running low.
Okay.
This forces the cell to switch gears, stop storing energy, like making fat, and start burning energy, like oxidizing fat.
Mm.
This shift can improve muscle endurance, and because it boosts overall cellular energy efficiency.
It's linked to longevity.
Directly linked to increasing both health span, the years you live healthily, and potentially lifespan itself. Improving mitochondrial function via AMPK is a major focus in anti-aging research.
And what about SS31? How does that help mitochondria?
SS31 takes a slightly different approach. It focuses on stabilizing the mitochondrial membranes.
The outer casing of the mitochondria.
Exactly. Think of the mitochondrion as the cell's battery. If the casing, the membrane, is damaged or leaky, the battery doesn't hold its charge well and energy production suffers.
Right.
SS31 helps protect and stabilize that membrane, improving the efficiency of cellular energy production. Practitioners mentioned it being potentially very helpful for conditions like chronic fatigue or supporting cognitive function. Basically anywhere cellular energy is low.
Fascinating. Okay, let's round out this section with peptides focused on the immune system and maybe more direct anti-aging effects.
A really important one here is thymosin alpha-1, or TA1. Like TB500, it's derived from the thymus gland.
The thymus is key for immunity, isn't it?
Absolutely. TA1 is considered a profound immune modulator. It's essential for the development of T cells, which are like the soldiers of your immune system.
Well, so it strengthens your core defenses.
Right. It supports overall immune health, thyroid function too, and sources cited it as critical for managing autoimmune conditions. It was also apparently used quite a bit during the pandemic due to its reported antiviral and antibacterial properties.
And then there was Epitalon. That one sounded almost sci-fi, linked to Russian longevity studies.
Epitalon, sometimes called epithalamin. Yeah, it really sits at the cutting edge of anti-aging peptide research. It's linked to potentially extending lifespan and enhancing cellular repair because it seems to play a role in regulating gene expression.
Like turning genes on or off.
That's the idea, helping to activate beneficial genes or suppress harmful ones. Its credibility gets a big boost from those long-term Russian studies you mentioned.
How long were those studies?
Some span 15 years, apparently, and they reported that the groups receiving Epitalon showed statistically significant reductions in overall mortality compared to control groups.
Reduced mortality from what specifically?
Particularly lower rates of cancer and cardiovascular disease were noted in the sources. The idea that a small peptide could influence gene expression for longevity is pretty remarkable.
Definitely. And lastly, for more external regeneration, skin and such, there was GHKQ, the copper peptide.
Right, GHKQ. It's a peptide naturally found in human plasma, but levels decline sharply as we age.
What does it do?
It's known to support deep wound healing and skin regeneration. It does this by stimulating the production of collagen and elastin-key structural proteins for skin, and it also acts as a potent antioxidant.
I feel like I've seen copper peptides in skincare products.
You absolutely have.
Okay.
The topical version is widely available in serums and creams. But practitioners also use an injectable form for potentially more profound, deep tissue anti-aging and regenerative effects.
And is that injectable form affected by the regulations?
Yes, that's one of the ones specifically targeted by the recent FDA restrictions we need to talk about.
Okay, so this incredible potential for healing, optimization, maybe even longevity seems almost too good to be true for some. And that brings us right into the thick of it, the regulatory pushback.
Yeah, it's a direct collision course. Because while these peptides can be expensive, getting them through compounding pharmacies often makes them dramatically more affordable than if they were developed and sold as patented billion-dollar drugs by Big Pharma.
And that affordability and accessibility seem to be at the heart of the tension, right?
Absolutely. It culminated in September 2023 when the FDA enacted a pretty sweeping restriction. They removed about 22 established peptides from the list of substances that compounding pharmacies are officially allowed to make.
And that list included many we just discussed?
It did. BPC-157, the CJ-cepamorlin combination, thymosin alpha-1. Several key players were suddenly off limits for these pharmacies.
What was the FDA's official reason for doing this? Why restrict access now?
Officially, the FDA statement cited concerns about insufficient safety data for these specific compounds. They also mentioned potential immunogenicity.
Immunogenicity, meaning the risk of the body having a weird immune reaction later on.
Sort of, yeah. The potential for it to provoke an unwanted immune response down the line. They frame it as a precaution due to what they perceive as a lack of large-scale, long-term clinical trials conducted specifically in the U.S. that meet their standards.
But the practitioners and advocates who actually use these therapies daily paint a very different picture. They argue there's a ton of evidence the FDA is ignoring.
They really do. Their main counterargument is that peptides, because they often mimic natural body processes, are inherently safer than many synthetic drugs with totally novel mechanisms.
They point to low side effect rates.
Extremely low risk of severe side effects, they argue. They give examples like thymosin alpha-1, which they say has been studied globally in over 8,000 patients.
Including very sick patients.
Yes, even including fragile ICU patients during the COVID pandemic, and it was found to be safe in those contexts. Another example they use is AOD9604, a fat loss peptide.
What about that one?
It actually achieved GRAS status, generally regarded as safe here in the U.S. That means it's literally considered safe enough to be used as a food additive. So they ask, how can compounds like that suddenly be deemed unsafe for compounding?
And they also push back on the idea that this is all new, untested science, right?
Absolutely. This isn't brand new tech. Mm-hmm. Insulin, the first really widely used peptide hormone, goes back to the 1920s.
Wow, okay.
TB500 and TA1 were identified back in the late 1970s. And BPC-157, while maybe newer to formal research, has apparently been used on the street, you know, by bodybuilders and athletes for joint and tendon repair for maybe 30 or 40 years.
So while that's not official clinical data, it's a long history of human use suggesting a certain level of safety.
That's the argument. Decades of empirical evidence shouldn't just be dismissed.
The immediate impact of these restrictions, according to the sources, is a real crisis of care for certain groups of patients.
Yeah, it creates a huge problem with continuity of care. Practitioners stress that the people who often benefit most from these peptides are those who've kind of failed conventional medicine.
Like who?
Patients with really complex autoimmune diseases, chronic pain syndromes that haven't responded to anything else, long-term chronic fatigue. For them, finding something that works is life-changing.
So taking away a peptide like TA1, if it was managing someone's autoimmune condition?
It leaves that patient completely stranded, often with no other viable option they haven't already tried and failed. The sources argue this ban is effectively denying access to essential medical care for these vulnerable populations.
Now, the sources got quite specific about why they believe the FDA took this action, alleging something they called regulatory capture. We need to be clear, we're reporting what the sources allege, not stating it as fact ourselves.
Right. Impartiality is key here. The practitioners point to what they see as suspicious patterns, particularly around the timing of these restrictions relative to competing brand name drugs.
What was the main example they cited?
The most immediate one was the timing around T-eptide. That's the generic name for the active ingredient in Mounjaro, a very popular GLP-1 agonist drug for diabetes and weight loss.
Okay, what happened with T-tide?
They alleged that around the same time the FDA restricted many compounded peptides, T-tide was placed onto the FDA's official drug shortage list.
What's the significance of being put on the shortage list? Does that mean compounders can make it?
No, exactly the opposite. It's a crucial regulatory technicality. When a drug is officially listed as being in shortage, compound pharmacies are legally prohibited from making generic versions of it.
Ah, so it prevents the affordable compounded alternative.
Precisely. It instantly removes the low-cost option, forcing patients who need that medication to pay top dollar for the brand name product, in this case, Eli Lilly's Mounjaro, which can cost, you know, $1,600 a month or more if insurance doesn't cover it well.
And the sources claim this isn't the first time they've seen this pattern.
No, they point to a similar situation previously with HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin, another hormone sometimes compounded.
What happened there?
They say that once the compounded version of HCG was restricted, the price of the main brand name version, Pregnal, just shot up almost overnight. Went from maybe $100 a vial to over $300.
So the functional medicine community sees a deliberate strategy.
They see a trend, yes.
Yeah.
Restrict the affordable compounded version, often citing safety or lack of data, right when the expensive brand name equivalent is gaining market traction or facing generic competition.
And the alleged end game is market control by big pharmaceutical companies, possibly even involving peptides themselves.
That's the core allegation. They point to reports that major companies, like Merck, for instance, are now apparently developing and submitting applications for their own patented versions of peptides, including potentially BPC-157.
I see.
So the argument from the practitioners is, the strategy seems clear. Use regulatory power to wipe out the existing affordable compounded market first. Then swoop in with your own patented version and charge premium monopolistic prices because there's no competition left.
So with these restrictions in place, the fight for access has shifted towards advocacy groups trying to push back. What's the specific goal they're working towards now?
Organizations like the Clinical Peptide Society, the International Peptide Society, they're heavily involved in lobbying, fundraising, potentially legal action. But the specific technical fix they're pushing for is to get USP monographs established for each of these restricted peptides.
USP monographs. What does that actually mean? What is USP?
USP stands for the United States Pharmacopeia. A USP monograph is basically the official, legally recognized rulebook for a substance. It defines its identity, its quality standards, purity, how it should be tested. It's the gold standard benchmark.
And why is having a USP monograph so important for compounding pharmacies?
Because compound pharmacies, especially the regulated ones known as 503A facilities, are generally required to follow USP standards when they make medications. If a peptide achieves a USP monograph, it essentially proves it meets a high standard of quality and characterization.
Which would undercut the FDA's argument about insufficient data or safety.
That's the hope. It would provide a strong legal and scientific basis for these regulated 503A pharmacies to argue that they can safely and legally resume producing these peptides according to recognized standards.
But if that advocacy fails, if the bans remain firmly in place, the sources warn about a potentially dangerous, unintended consequence.
Yeah, this is the real paradox they highlight. If you cut off the supply from the legal, regulated, clean compounding pharmacies, the 503A facilities that follow strict quality controls,
the demand doesn't just disappear.
Right.
People will still seek them out.
Exactly. The huge public demand just shifts entirely underground into the completely unregulated gray and black markets. Websites often selling things labeled for research purposes only, operating with absolutely zero oversight.
And sourcing complex injectable compounds from those kinds of places sounds incredibly risky. What are the specific dangers?
Oh, the risks skyrocket. You're talking about potential contamination with heavy metals, lead, arsenic, things that might be used in raw material processing in non-sterile labs overseas.
Heavy metals, wow.
Bacterial or fungal contamination is a huge risk, too, if they're not made in sterile environments. And maybe most dangerously, improper dosing or outright fraud. Selling a vial labeled as 10 milligrams that actually contains only 1 milligram, or maybe it's contaminated with something else entirely, or it's not even the right peptide.
That sounds terrifyingly dangerous.
It is. And the ultimate fear expressed in the sources is this: if people start getting seriously harmed or even die from using contaminated black market peptides,
The FDA will have justification to crack down even harder.
precisely. It could lead to an even broader, more severe ban on all peptides, lumping the safe ones in with the dangerous situation created by the initial ban. The regulated community insists they want quality control enforced. They want standards like USP monographs. They just don't want the entire supply chain from reputable 503A pharmacies eliminated, pushing everyone towards danger.
This whole situation really highlights a fundamental difference in philosophy between how functional medicine approaches things versus maybe more conventional routes, especially when comparing peptides to traditional hormone replacement therapy or HRT.
Absolutely. The sources laid out a kind of hierarchy that these practitioners often advocate.
What's that hierarchy?
It generally goes, one, lifestyle first. Always start with optimizing the foundations: diet, exercise, sleep, stress management.
Makes sense. The basics.
Two, peptides. Second, if lifestyle isn't enough, use peptides for targeted optimization, repair, or signaling support that the body isn't achieving on its own.
Okay, as a boost.
Three, HRT or traditional drugs third. Only turn to direct hormone replacement or conventional pharmaceuticals as a last resort when the body's own systems are truly failing or unable to respond adequately.
And that hierarchy seems entirely based on that core difference in how they work, especially that reverse feedback loop idea we touched on with GH.
Exactly. Let's revisit that because it's crucial. HRT typically involves direct external supplementation of the final hormone, like taking testosterone injections or estrogen pills.
You're adding the hormone from the outside.
Right. And the body, being smart and efficient, detects this big influx of external hormone. It says, okay, we've got plenty. And it signals the pituitary gland and other hormone-producing glands to just stop making their own. That's the reverse feedback loop kicking in.
And over time, that suppression causes problems.
It can lead to dependency. The body's natural production machinery gets lazy or even atrophies because it's not being used. The glands become less responsive.
So, if the pituitary is the master switch, HRT, especially long term or high dose, basically teaches that switch to stay off or at least get really sluggish.
That's a good way to think about it. Like muscle atrophy in a cast, if you don't use it, you lose it, or at least weaken it significantly.
Yeah.
Your endocrine glands can become less capable over time.
Okay, so how do peptides differ in their mechanism?
Peptides, particularly the secret agogues like the GHRPs we discussed, are stimulatory. They don't provide the end hormone. Instead, they gently nudge the pituitary or other relevant glands to increase their own natural production and release.
They're encouraging the body's system, not replacing it.
Precisely. They work with the body's internal management system. They support the natural feedback loops rather than shutting them down. This is why they generally don't suppress the body's core ability to produce its own hormones, making them potentially a better, more sustainable choice for long-term optimization, according to these sources.
Does that difference in mechanism also translate to different side effect profiles?
Generally, yes. Because HRT involves flooding the system with the end hormone, you often see more systemic side effects. Things like mood swings, maybe excessive water retention, acne. And there's the ongoing debate about potential increased risk long term of certain hormone-sensitive cancers like breast or prostate cancer.
Okay.
Peptides, on the other hand, tend to be much more targeted signals. They act more specifically on the cells or glands they're designed to influence. So when used correctly, the sources suggest they usually lead to better tolerance and fewer unwanted systemic side effects.
Now, we absolutely have to talk about the elephant in the room when it comes to popular peptides, the GLP-1 agonists,
Yeah.
semaglutide, Ozempic, Wegovy, and tirzepatide, Mounjaro. Technically, these are peptides.
We are, yes. They mimic the action of the natural GLP-1 hormone.
But our sources expressed some pretty strong cautions, didn't they? Particularly about the high doses currently being used for rapid weight loss.
They did. While acknowledging the legitimate power of GLP-1, signaling for metabolic health, and blood sugar control, they view the way these drugs are sometimes being used now, very high doses, solely for cosmetic weight loss, as potentially dangerous.
What was their main concern? The biggest warning sign?
The primary red flag raised repeatedly was the risk of significant muscle wasting, also known as sarcopenia.
How much muscle loss are we talking about? And it can't be that much, can it?
Well, practitioners in the sources reported seeing cases where up to 50% of the total weight lost by patients on these high doses was actually lean muscle mass, not fat.
50%? Half the weight lost is muscle. That sounds terrible.
It's profoundly concerning from a longevity perspective. And this is where they issued that stark warning. Losing that much metabolically active muscle mass is functionally equivalent to aging your body by about 20 years.
Aging you 20 years? How?
Because you become frail, weak. Your metabolism tanks because muscle burns calories at rest. You lose strength, stability. Muscle isn't just for looks or lifting things. It's increasingly recognized as a crucial longevity organ.
A longevity organ? Why?
Muscle plays a huge role in insulin sensitivity. The more muscle you have, the better your body handles blood sugar. It dictates your baseline metabolic rate. And critically, it protects against frailty and falls as you age, which are major predictors of lifespan and health span.
So sacrificing potentially half your muscle mass just to get thinner quickly?
Could radically accelerate your biological aging process, making you look thinner but actually become much older and less healthy internally. It completely reframes the quick fix aspect.
Wow. Okay, so if the high-dose injectable route carries these risks, what's the safer, more natural alternative for improving GLP-1 signaling and metabolism, according to the sources?
The preferred approach is always to try and stimulate your body's own natural GLP-1 release first.
How do you do that?
The source material really emphasized a lifestyle approach, prioritizing a diet high in protein and high in fiber, incorporating fermented foods, getting enough healthy omega-3 fatty acids, and, crucially, consistently engaging in resistance training weightlifting.
Lifting weights helps GLP-1.
Yes. Resistance training is a powerful stimulus for improving metabolic health and insulin sensitivity. This combination diet, healthy fats, fiber, fermented foods, and lifting weights, is seen as the way to safely optimize your body's metabolic signaling without the potentially devastating side effect of massive muscle loss.
Okay, we started this whole discussion by defining peptides as these naturally occurring chains of amino acids. Let's bring it full circle now. How can people actually get beneficial peptides through their diet without injections or supplements?
Yeah, it's important to remember these things exist in nature. The sources were very clear. Probably the single greatest, most concentrated natural source of a wide variety of peptides is organ meats.
Organ meats, like liver, kidney.
Exactly. Liver, heart, kidney, thymus gland were all mentioned. There's that historical concept in traditional medicine, eating the organ to support the health of your own corresponding organ.
Eat liver for liver health, eat heart for heart health.
Kind of like that, yeah. The idea is these foods are just packed with the specific signaling molecules and building blocks that those tissues need.
Okay, but organ meats aren't exactly mainstream for everyone these days. What about more common, accessible sources?
Bone broth and collagen powders are huge sources of peptides. Collagen itself breaks down into short, easily absorbed amino acid chains, collagen peptides that directly support joint health, skin elasticity, gut lining integrity.
Right, collagen is everywhere now.
And the other one highlighted was raw dairy. Particularly colostrum, the very first milk produced after birth.
Colostrum.
Yeah, it's absolutely loaded with growth factors, regenerative peptides, and various immunomodulators designed to kickstart the newborn's immune system and growth.
Interesting. So nature does provide these compounds. Okay, we've covered a massive amount of ground, the science, the applications, the controversy. Let's wrap up by quickly tackling some common myths people might still have about peptides using the facts we've discussed.
Good idea. Let's bust some myths. Myth one, peptides are illegal.
Is that true?
Generally false, or at least misleading. While many aren't FDA approved as prescription drugs, that doesn't automatically make them illegal across the board. Many are perfectly legal to sell and possess as research compounds, or they can be legally made by compounding pharmacies if they meet regulatory requirements, like having that USP monograph we talked about. It's more nuanced than just legal versus illegal. Think of it like raw milk legal in some places, restricted in others, but not inherently forbidden substance everywhere.
Okay, good clarification. Myth two, peptides are just steroids in disguise.
Definitely false. Huge difference. As we discussed, Peptides are typically stimulatory. They signal your body to enhance its own natural processes. Steroids, on the other hand, are generally synthetic hormones that replace or massively override your body's natural production, often leading to that suppressive feedback loop.
Completely different mechanisms and risk profiles.
Totally different.
All right. Myth three. Peptides are brand new, untested, fringe science.
Also false. We already mentioned insulin going back a century. Peptides have been fundamental to medicine for a very long time. And think about other common wellness staples, things like glutathione, a tripeptide antioxidant, creatine derived from amino acids, collagen peptides. These are all examples of peptides or amino acid-based compounds that have been studied and used safely for decades. They are not some new invention.
Excellent points. So we've seen this incredible potential, right, for healing, for optimizing performance and health span, maybe even longevity. We've seen how they might be safer than traditional HRT in many cases because they work with the body.
And we've seen the significant safety data and long history of use that supports many of them.
But then we keep hitting this wall, the regulatory hurdles, the fight for access, this whole medical freedom angle.
It really is the central conflict, isn't it? The story of peptides showcases this amazing promise of targeted therapies that mimic nature, crashing right into the immense power of regulatory gatekeeping and potentially market forces.
It forces you to ask some tough questions.
It really does. Mm-hmm. And maybe the most critical question, the provocative thought to leave people with, is this. If the experienced practitioners, the clinicians who have dedicated years to learning how to safely and effectively manage these nuanced peptide therapies, if they lose access to the high-quality, sterile, reliably dosed peptides from regulated compounding pharmacies,
then what happens? What's the real price the public pays?
Exactly. Because the demand won't just vanish. People seeking relief or optimization will still look for these compounds.
So the unintended consequence of trying to enforce safety by eliminating the regulated supply
is that you might inadvertently drive everyone towards the only remaining source.
Yep.
The completely uncontrolled, potentially contaminated, and genuinely dangerous black market.
Where the risks of heavy metals, bacteria, wrong doses, or fake products are astronomically high.
That's the core argument advocates are making. That trying to ensure safety by shutting down the known, regulated 503A pharmacies paradoxically creates a far greater public health risk from the inevitable rise of the unregulated market. They argue the truly ethical, safer path is to establish clear standards like USP monographs and allow the reputable facilities to continue providing clean, reliable products.
That is definitely a powerful and provocative thought for regulators and for all of us to consider. A really complex situation with no easy answers.
It certainly is.
Well, thank you so much for guiding us through this incredibly detailed and dynamic deep dive. That was fascinating, covering the science, the potential, and that whole complex controversy.
My pleasure. It's a rapidly evolving field, that's for sure.
If you, the listener, want to explore any of the resources, the concepts we discussed today, maybe find links to those advocacy groups mentioned, you can find all of that in our show notes. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.